You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. News media manipulates what becomes an issue and what doesn't, both by what and how it covers ideas and events and by what it omits from its coverage. Who decides what is news and why? Tonight we'll continue with our Radio Netherlands series on propaganda by taking a look at what gets left out of the news. Then we'll hear a recent forum with Professor Noam Chomsky that presents the issue of terrorism from a perspective almost never presented in establishment media outlets.
Radio Netherlands, The Sound Fountain, presents War of Words, a four-part series on information and conflict. In part two, The Cutting Room, Corporate Media Joins the Fight. The program is produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
And we, the democracies of this world,
we will use whatever means are necessary to achieve our objectives.
The cutting room floor is where a lot of information ends up during war and peacetime, often not due to censorship, but rather a complex form of self-censorship by corporate-run media. So just what is being cut out or added in, and why? This program focuses on the American media, but could apply to corporate media in any country. Today on the cutting room floor, from Geneva, Johan Galtung, the founder of Peace Studies. From Amsterdam, Stace Hamelink, Professor of International Communications. From London, Alan Davis, of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. From San Francisco, journalist and author Mark Hertzgaard. And from New York, Steve Rendall, Senior Analyst for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
I mean, you have some very extraordinary relationships in U.S. media. You have NBC. One of the major television networks is owned by GE, one of the biggest defense contractors in the world. You know, they make not only make nuclear power plants, but they make a whole array of high-tech weaponry. They were, at one point, the biggest military manufacturing company in the world. Now they own a television network. 30 years ago, this couldn't have happened. We had antitrust laws in place that would have kept that from happening. Apparently, the journalistic ethics of NBC don't encompass the fact that they should not be owned by a defense contractor either. You know, a major, the biggest budget item in the United States. And the press lives off corporate money. It lives off corporate advertising. Even if you discount the fact that these news agencies are owned by giant corporations who have all of the interests of giant corporations, their bread and butter is a daily infusion of corporate advertising dollars, of money for advertising from other giant corporations. And so what you have is the corporate interest infuses the government, infuses the media. You know, there's all sorts of political fights about these things, not even to mention the fact that they benefit and profit substantially from war when wars happen. But we have all sorts of relationships like this throughout the American press. So if you want to hear dissenting voices, if you wanted to hear people, critical voices about the U.S. response, about what George Bush said, that we were attacked on September 11th because we're a shining beacon of democracy and freedom, don't look to the mainstream American press to tell you, gee, if we're such a shining beacon of democracy and freedom, how come all of our allies in the Middle East are corrupt and anti-democratic?
Those bases built up with Saudi money and American contractors would make the best strategic launch pad against Iraq. Turkey, theoretically, would be the next best base. And Jurlik has been used for flights.
The American press is owned by the biggest transnational corporations in the world, and they are not in the habit of hiring people who are going to hurt their bottom line.
Author Mark Hertzgaard.
Now, that doesn't mean that we journalists are told on a daily basis, don't do this story, don't do that story, do this instead. It's a subtler process than that. News, you know, is very fast. It's a breaking thing. You cannot possibly intervene if you're the corporate superior every day. You don't have time. Instead, what happens is you hire the people in those jobs who will make the decisions that you like. And you get rid of the people if they make decisions that you don't like. Now, I had personal experience with this a number of times. I was once fired from a national public radio because I did a little satire that poked fun at McDonald's and NBC television. And my boss told me, "You were criticizing the free enterprise system, and you can't do that." It was that direct. Now, usually, the censorship is not expressed that directly because most reporters don't have to be told. Most reporters don't go over that line. I'm an outsider. I'm a freelancer. I'm not on staff at these places, and I'm not going to make that deal. I'm not going to censor myself. You know, journalists get messages every day from their superiors according to, well, what story got printed and what story didn't? What assignments do I get and what assignments do they not give me? What story ideas get accepted for pursuit and what story ideas are rejected? Who gets promoted? Who doesn't get promoted? It's like any job. You see what your superiors want and you either give it to them if you want to advance or you don't and you leave. So in that sense, it's not much different than other jobs. It's just that the effect of it is very important to our democracy, and it ends up leaving our democracy impoverished because we do not hear in any meaningful way criticisms of the basic power relations in American society, whether it be corporate or the political elite.
How influential are journalists in conflict situations?
Alan Davis of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
We did a study on that, not in Afghanistan because it's too recent, but our study looked at Cambodia, Georgia in the Caucasus, Bosnia and South Africa, and basically concluded that the media has been a power for evil in actually encouraging the conditions for conflicts.
I think this is typical when you live in the middle of an empire and you're looking at their media, as you're going to see a lot of stuff that just really echoes. We talk about having three branches of government. We have the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. Then we also refer to the press as the fourth estate. So what we say here often is that the press is often a fourth branch of government, that it just echoes official agendas, and occasionally a dissenting voice will get in, rarely during wartime, but occasionally a dissenting voice will get in, but it's really very rare for that to happen. So what we've seen the media do is sort of carry forth the official U.S. agenda, the White House agenda on the war against terrorism. During any military buildup in the United States, what you see is even a narrower debate. And what we've seen is a virtual rumble line of militarists, all of the networks hire ex-generals, ex-Pentagon employees. Do they go out to universities and find people who've spent decades studying peace, studying international diplomacy, studying international law and human rights? No, they don't.
And from our studio in London, we have Ron Willis, an expert on international security.
Our expert at the Pentagon is standing by.
Carl Mills is the head of a think tank which advises the government on defense issues.
Our newspapers, our media, emerged in a period in world history when the nation state was very strong. And the nation state was growing and the media were growing. I'm talking about, if you will, the 19th century, to some extent before that, and certainly also the 20th century, the century behind us.
Peace activist Johan Galtung.
I think you can find in almost all countries that there is one or two newspapers and one or two channels and one or two radio stations that the government thinks they can rely upon, like there is one or two universities. And I don't care so much about the others, as long as these people can be defined as, quote, experts, unquote, being the ones that people will listen to. Now, the word expert has an aura of authorization about it. I'm always extremely skeptical when I hear an expert, because I know that I'll get something dishonest. Not in the sense that he's lying, but in the sense that he's leaving out things. And that is usually what the governments would like him to do.
To say that the media was following some popular patriotic upsurge would be putting the cart before the horse. The media is at the forefront of leading and trying to engender that popular upsurge of patriotism, as they would call it. Patriotism is a huge word here, and it only has one meaning in the sort of mass media understanding of it, and that is that you support the United States, right or wrong. And of course, in their view, it's always right these days.
Maria Rose Abad.
Michael Essien.
Thomas J. Ashton.
Janice Marie Ashley.
The names of all of the 2,801 people who died in the World Trade Center were read out on the anniversary of September 11th. The American media put a human face on each one of the victims. The full weight of the tragedy emerged with their identification as mothers, fathers, children, neighbors. But Afghanistan is also a country of mothers, fathers, children, and neighbors. How many of them have been shot, or blown up, or starved? And why don't we know?
The thing that strikes us most about the bombing in Afghanistan is the lack of reporting on civilian casualties. There's been virtually zero reporting on civilian casualties here in the United States, and that is because reporters here are taking their leads from the Pentagon and from the White House. The Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, who's the chief of the Pentagon, came out and said that there was no way they could provide numbers on civilian casualties to reporters because, after all, the fog of war, it's too hard, there's too much confusion there, and you can't tell. Well, other groups are able to get these numbers, and if the Pentagon can't, well, it's not believable that they can't. However, the U.S. press has taken the Pentagon at its word and sort of, you know, not taken any real interest.
There has been an attack on from the air on a leadership compound southeast of Kandahar. Whoever was there is going to wish they weren't, but in terms of their names, I don't have them.
When there's a major superpower fighting a war, it's harder to actually check the veracity of what's happened rather than easier. Let's look at Afghanistan in the last sort of 6, 7, 8 months. There's been a little debate, but not much, surprisingly not much at all, about the level of Afghan casualties. Given this is a war, you actually think that that should be the first question on everybody's mind every day. How many people have been killed in this war? How many people have been injured? And if you actually just paid attention to the Pentagon press briefings, you'd get the view that, well, there's been no casualties at all, or maybe there's been a couple of hundred here and there, what have you. But some people, I think an American academic who's done some research into this, said it could be up to sort of, you know, 40, 50, 60,000 people. And then when he or somebody else comes up with these kind of figures, a lot of people say, well, you know, where do you get these figures from? That's nonsense. But in which case, if it's nonsense, who, if not this person, is actually collating these figures?
It's really quite an extraordinary point of view about war that the United States has come to have. I guess since Grenada, Panama in 1989, the Gulf War in 1991, and Kosovo, and now this, I guess the United States is becoming accustomed to having these clean little wars that they mainly fight from a distance. I mean, one of the jokes that we tell around here is the U.S. infantry is generally further back from the action in these wars than the U.S. press is, and that's pretty far away.
I went through all the clippings that were reported in World Press Review, which is a monthly magazine, on September 11 and its aftermath, and a couple of other sources, so let us say about 1,000 reports. And, of course, it is very clear that the diagnosis, the analysis, is different depending on where you are. So if it is from the West, it was an attack by evil forces against democracy, civilization, our cultural values. And that was the main approach taken. There were some dissident voices pointing out that maybe it also had to do with something in Western politics, but there were not very many. If you then go to the Islamic world, and especially to the Arab countries, you will find shock and rejection of the approach, but at the same time that it is understandable, given Western and particularly United States foreign policy. So you can say in a sense that the diagnosis is very easily predicted, although it was not to be expected that the Western press, with the so-called openness of Western societies, where mainstream press is concerned, was so unanimous in imitating the U.S. presidency. There was one uniform thing that went through, practically speaking, all the 1,000, not a single proposal. Absolutely nothing. Zero. Nil. Which is amazing. Here you have a major thing going on, and the media are operating in such a way that they do not produce suggestions, proposals. I find that shocking.
The American media is not, by nature, an adversarial media. It tends to reflect the views of the political class, especially the Washington Press Corps. And, you know, those reporters will tell you, our job is not to be pro or con on the president. Our job is to report what he does and to be what they call objective. And in the name of political neutrality, reporters in Washington tend to believe that what they need to do is essentially report what the big players are saying. So I call the Washington Press Corps a palace court press, because they are just like the palace court courtiers of, you know, the Middle Ages. They're very good at saying what the king wants to do and who's influencing the king, president that is, to push this way. The Cheney and the Rumsfeld faction want to invade Iraq, but the Powell and Condoleezza Rice faction are nervous. They're quite good at that. And they're very good at saying what the reaction on Capitol Hill is, all the intrigues of palace politics. But they never stand back from that and give a truly critical view or offer alternative analyses.
If I could sum up Fair's problem with the U.S. press, it would be this. We see one of the main tasks of journalism as monitoring power, going to those in charge and holding their feet to the fire, making sure that you ask tough questions, you scrutinize power wherever it is and however it's acting, and whatever your own personal politics are as a journalist, you have to monitor and ask tough questions of power. This just isn't done here. And it's never done. It doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or a Republican. The tough questions, if you ask tough questions in a Pentagon briefing room, you will soon find that your access to that briefing room becomes very difficult.
The president hasn't held a news conference since last July. He's held two this year. Isn't that a long time? I mean, with all due respect to you, Harry, you're a very good spokesman, I suppose, for the White House.
Keep going, Helen.
Really would like to question the president on all the statements he's made, and it can only come from him.
Helen, your views on this are well known, and you've articulated them. No, I understand the press's views on this. Let me take that. The president continues to take a great many questions from reporters in numerous different forums, and I understand that you would like him to take questions in the form of a news conference. I assure you we take a look at this often and
say no.
And say no.
And you will often, when you ask tough questions, see the other journalists, the other better-behaved journalists in the room, look at you like you're of some sort of a freak.
In the context of September 11th, if you're seen to be asking too many questions, you're then, as George Bush would say, if you're not for us, you're against us. If you're not for invasion of Iraq and the deposition of Saddam Hussein, well, you're against it, and you support him. I mean, you know, that the two are not synonymous there, and that's the problem. So I think it's a big problem in America where people in the media are starting to be very nervous about asking questions. I mean, it now seems the FBI are actually going into libraries in America and actually asking for records of what people have been reading or whatever. Crazy things that happen in America now. And so if a journalist is actually trying to say, well, sorry, Mr. George Bush, where's your proof that we've got chemical weapons plants in Baghdad or whatever, why can't we let the UN inspectors get on with their job? Let's send in more UN inspectors. Let's actually have more congressional visits to Baghdad. Let's actually, you know, get some dialogue going here. Anybody actually starts to say that will be automatically within the media booed, you know, you're not on the side, you're not on the team, get on the team. So the climate for actually asking probing questions is not right, and that's a worrying thing. There's a sort of a, in the context of September 11th, it's basically, you know, good versus bad, evil versus good.
Bearing in mind that there's many journalists of good faith working at these mainstream media outlets who are trying to do a good job under very difficult conditions, the tone of the American press has been shameless jingoism, cheerleading, with very little else. We had a whole debate here about should the television networks regularly fly the American flag logo on their screens down in the corner while they're reporting on the news being generated out of the quote-unquote terror war. This is completely unprofessional. Displaying the actual colors, you know, flying the colors of one of the subjects of your story, it's gotten that bad. Many of them don't even realize what a severe undermining of their professional standards that represents. The media, too often, is simply a public relations arm of U.S. official agendas, of the Bush White House, Pentagon, State Department, what have you. So what's happened is, and the same thing happens every time we get into war. I mean, George Bush's father had a 91% approval rating in the middle of the Gulf War. When the war was over, a few months later, he lost sort of ignominiously in a presidential election. The consolation for those who are a little bit afraid when any government leader has a 90% plus approval rating, the consolation is that this approval is very shallow. It's not based on any sort of deep respect that Americans have for George W. Bush. It's because it's all generated by media. Because one story is about, gee, what a take charge guy. We thought he was a dunce. We thought he was an idiot before, but now that there's a war, we find out that he's really grown into the job. He's really a wonderful leader. And now we're going to do a story about Tom Cruise. And that's how it works. So it's all very fleeting and mercurial.
And turning from world news to today's top celebrity story, shoppers in New York were surprised to see the star of the primetime television series Top of the World lining up at their local video store.
This is the problem that we're now facing. There's a blurring of news already with entertainment and information. News used to be news, used to be news. Now, as we see in America, CNN is owned now, I think, by Time Warner, which also makes, you know, movies. We used to say good things, we used to say bad things about CNN, but in terms of the Afghan coverage, I think the winner in terms of the media market in America was Fox News, and Fox News dressed up their coverage to be much more entertainment than actually news. There was the famous case of the news anchor actually going to Afghanistan, packing a pistol and actually taking aim at so-called Al-Qaeda and firing it. And this was actually shown on primetime American TV.
Television news is almost totally useless. I mean, if you take one of the major news broadcasts, each of the three major networks in the United States put on a half-hour news broadcast each early evening, about 6:30 here in New York, and of the half-hour, 9 or 10 minutes of that is taken up with advertisements. So you have 20 minutes to cover the world. Now, some of that 20 minutes is also taken up with celebrity fluff and gossip and stories that tout other programming on their network. So in the end, you get almost nothing.
The problem is, in 3 minutes, you can't afford, or you're not allowed by your news editor to give the context. If you talk about yesterday, somebody will say, well, that's yesterday. What happened now? What's going to happen tonight or tomorrow? So there's no ability to actually give the background to a conflict, and in not giving the background to a conflict, you're not actually explaining the conflict. The problem is that if one channel was to do that, then they would be always looking over their back to say, well, if we're sort of sticking our neck out and actually trying to explain, trying to give context, will the public switch off? Will the advertisers pull out? Will people move to another channel which is much more interesting and entertainment-y, what have you. So one should flag that there are serious commercial considerations in running a news channel, and that's a big problem. Newsweek or Time always say it, when we put a very hard-hitting cover story that's a war or suffering or what have you, Janine or something, circulation goes down dramatically. If we put a rock star or Michael Jackson or somebody on the cover, it goes up. I noticed the Daily Mirror here in London recently had a front page story on Britain selling arms and airplanes to Israel during the current crisis there. And sadly, you're going to find out next week that circulation of Daily Mirror dropped dramatically when the competitors were selling stories, front page stories about David Beckham or what have you.
We get the kind of reporting that our society, in a sense, programs us to want. There is a kind of sensationalism that sells, and there's no doubt about that. But I'm convinced that newspapers would sell much better in the longer run if they were able to produce what I would then call peace journalism, where the focus would be much more on what's the nature of the conflict and how can it be solved. Now, that doesn't mean that one shouldn't report the violence, but it should not be 98% of the reporting, with practically speaking nothing devoted to solutions at all. And I say that because I think particularly women are much more interested in peace journalism than war journalism. So there is another point here, namely, who is buying the family newspaper? Is it the husband on the way back from job, picking up the afternoon trash, excuse me, to bring it down to the household? Or could it be also an appeal more for the women to buy?
Ultimately, if you're going to bring peace to a region, it's not the international players who you need to convince. It's the local combatants, it's the local civilians, it's the local politicians and activists. We've been too long focusing on what the international community thinks, because we're all too familiar with what CNN and the BBC and what the international states people think. And it's about time that we heard what the local stakeholders think. As September 11th showed us, the danger has been in retreating for various reasons, for reasons of economies or what have you, in actually closing down bureaus and retreating back to London or New York or Paris or Tokyo or Geneva. The intelligence that world media actually generates was not as good. And the level of understanding between different cultures has been pretty poor. So the best way of moving forward from September 11th is actually to say, well, let's use and listen more to local voices, because actually local voices are telling us right from the horse's mouth what local societies are doing, thinking and wishing for.
I still basically believe that people have that capacity to go through all these messages, filter them out.
Professor Faith Hamelink.
And I think we can make an enormous difference together, because in the end, you know, if citizens simply say, take the case of the news. Most of the news programs around the world are just like with most newspapers, it's a commercial proposition. Now, you can talk until the cows come home about how dangerous it is that this is all controlled by people like Rupert Murdoch and Berlusconi and so on and so forth. But that's only true to some extent. The news flows are controlled by the millions of people who buy the newspapers that Mr. Murdoch produces. Many of these millions wouldn't like his lousy newspaper so much. He would have to make a different newspaper, and he would. I remember from a conversation I had many, many years ago with Ted Turner about CNN, you know, that he was very clear on that. You know, he seems to think that since millions of people around the world like CNN so much as the most reliable news source in all these international conflicts, he says, why would I change that? Because of some free-floating sociologist who thinks it's all wrong. No, but if millions of people around the world say we want to have a different type of CNN, you know, that's maybe less American, that's maybe less biased, and so on, then he says, of course, we would have to do it. It's a bit like the good old story in Alice in Wonderland, you know, when one of the figures during a tea party says, but if you like what you get what you like. That's what the media barons say. People like it, apparently. There's very little protest, so if they like what they get, no, then they get what they like.
You've been listening to The Cutting Room, part two of the Sound Fountain series War of Words, produced and presented by Michelle Ernsting.
Constitution's framers' insistence on press freedom assumed that the role of the press in society would be to serve as a watchdog against abuse of power by the state. The underground press of the day, such as the pamphlets of Thomas Paine, played a key role in galvanizing the colonists to revolt against the crown by detailing incidents of tyranny. The situation today of a press that engages in widespread self-censorship because of its owners' connections to or membership in America's ruling elite has created a climate where even asking certain types of questions damages the, quote, credibility of the news outlet. And this attitude has filtered into the alternative press as well. Kelly Ramirez is a journalist at KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. She published the following piece on November 7th in a web-based news outlet called OnlineJournal.org. The title is, Was Wellstone Murdered? It's a legitimate question journalists must feel free to ask. She writes, soon after the news of Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone's death hit the wires, I got a phone call in the newsroom of radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California. The caller was a listener who said that after hearing of Wellstone's death, he called the Washington, D.C. office of Senator Barbara Boxer, Democrat of California, to urge that the senator get the Canadian government to investigate the circumstances of Wellstone's plane crash. The listener also said that Boxer's staff told him that they were getting, quote, flooded with calls urging that the Canadians or some other foreign government investigate the crash. The next day, I moderated a teach-in after a major anti-war demonstration in San Francisco. The second speaker asked the audience of approximately 40 people, does anyone here not think that Wellstone's plane crash was a hit? No one raised a hand. As I circulated among the literature tables during one of the speeches, I noted that people were talking about the news reports on Wellstone's death and that they had been paying attention to how the stories evolved. It seemed that the later the report, the worse the weather was near the Eveleth, Virginia, Minnesota airport at the time of the crash. Although the possibility of icing seemed to be the concern of the networks by Saturday evening, several people at the teach-in were aware of the exchange between CNN's Wolf Blitzer and a reporter on the scene who discounted weather problems. From CNN's initial report, the crews on the ground found two large sections of plane. The tail section was intact. The weather did not have anything to do with the crash, said the on-the-scene reporter. Wolf Blitzer tried to correct her. He said, the plane was flying into the storm of freezing rain, right? There's no evidence that weather had anything to do with the crash. The on-scene reporter stuck to her guns. Peruse the internet and you will easily find people who doubt that the crash was an accident, and they back up those doubts with rational questions about the flight and rational concerns about the state of the country. But Wellstone was barely in his grave when a news director on a radio listserv to which I belong made a comment that is typical, even stereotypical, of what I've come to call the lily-livered left. Quote, I can't stand it how so many people, not just in the left, get invested in conspiracy theories when the power structures anyone can see and observe in broad daylight suffice to explain what's going on. More than once I heard callers to Talk of the Nation or The Connection start making truthful-to-the-mark observations about power politics, only to veer off into lunatic conspiracy theories, disqualifying their entire statement. Thanks a lot, man. May I remind people that air travel is dangerous? In January, an FAA inspector died in a plane crash in Alaska, called to investigate the high incidence of plane crashes there. A conspiracy? How about bad weather? Please, I'm not denying that we have murderous power structures, but I don't like it when people start discrediting themselves, especially when they are in the alternative media business. Close quote. Yes, bad weather happens, mechanical parts fail, pilots make mistakes, and birds fly into planes. All these matters are being investigated in the Wellstone case, rightly so. Here are some of the preliminary findings. Safety record of the type of aircraft involved. 50 accidents involving King Air A100s have occurred since 1975, according to the FAA. 5 were fatal, but 3 of those 5 weren't the plane's fault. King Air A100 accidents since 1975 have killed 8 people in the United States and injured 9 others. The aircraft's safety record is particularly impressive considering its widespread use, from the Duluth Superior 1025-02. Experience of the pilots. Only one pilot is required to fly the plane. 2 were hired because a senator was on board. The pilots of Wellstone's plane. Connery had nearly 5,200 hours of flying time and the highest certification a pilot can attain, his company said. Guess had 650 hours and was certified as a commercial pilot. He graduated from UND's aeronautics program. From the Minneapolis Star Tribune, 1026-02. Physical condition of the pilots. Dr. Thomas Uncini, St. Louis County's chief medical examiner, said Monday his preliminary conclusions are that the 2 pilots were in good physical condition and there were no signs that they suffered a heart attack or stroke. "No, it didn't happen," he said, of medical problems. "It looked pretty straightforward." From the 1029-02 St. Paul Pioneer Press. Newspaper reports, as well as an email exchange I've had with a former private pilot, indicate a catastrophic loss of control in the last minutes of the flight. In an airplane with a good reputation, 2 fully qualified pilots in good health, the more experienced of whom had passed a test required to maintain licensure just 2 days before. Think about it again. Last-minute catastrophic loss of control of an airplane that was carrying a man with a reputation as being the most liberal U.S. senator, who was last on the Chamber of Commerce's list of business-friendly senators, who was the only senator up for re-election in a close race who voted against Bush's Iraq War resolution, who was regarded as an enemy by those who occupy the White House, and who was holding a seat the White House wanted in order to regain control of the Senate. And the polls were showing that Wellstone's no vote on the Iraq War resolution was gaining him support. Those of us who look askance at coincidence theory are wondering, what are the odds that 2 Democratic Senate candidates in 2 closely contested races important to the Bush camp would die in purely accidental plane crashes in the waning days of their campaigns in 2 consecutive election cycles. According to the airport manager, the pilots clicked on the runway lights by sending a signal from the plane and were never heard from again. Maybe the switch that turned on the runway lights was rigged with a gas bomb, knocking out both pilots who slumped over their controls, causing the plane to take a steep dive into the ground. Then again, maybe shortly after the pilots clicked on the runway lights, a stray loon flew into the windscreen, shattering it, knocking out both pilots who slumped over their controls, causing the plane to take a steep dive into the ground. Down journalism, especially in today's political climate, asks both questions. Lily-livered leftists concerned with being, quote, discredited by whom, discredit themselves by closing off the possibility of foul play. As anyone familiar with the entertainment industry knows, plane crashes happen. That fact also makes it easy to dismiss and hide sabotage. The world is full of criminals. People with such a lust for power or taste for money that they are not beyond killing someone or paying off someone to kill if it suits their goals. It's an ugly reality, but assassination happens. So why do some journalists feel the need to demonize the possibility of conspiracy with adjectives such as lunatic? After all, doesn't organized crime exist? What about the corporate executives who are being led away in handcuffs these days? Does anyone seriously believe that each person guilty of crimes in the current corporate accounting scandals acted alone in total ignorance of what their colleagues were doing? If there is concerted action in criminal enterprises such as drug trafficking, And in the so-called legitimate business world, for example, Arthur Anderson, isn't it lunacy to believe that criminal conspiracies never ever happen in politics? Indeed, if the plane that crashed had carried Bush, Cheney, or any of the cabinet members to their deaths, wouldn't assassination be the first thing everyone would be investigating? In fact, the first assumption in their cases would be, it was Al-Qaeda. Terrorism was briefly raised and quickly eliminated in the Wellstone case. Isn't any terrorist organization a criminal conspiracy? I think that the facile dismissal of the possibility of foul play in Wellstone's case is symptomatic of the state of denial many media makers are in concerning the ruthlessness of the Bush camp. What reason is there to believe that there is some magical moral bright line that these political actors who have committed atrocities abroad would refuse to cross in pursuing their agenda at home? The notion that there would never be criminal conspiracies among the highest echelons of American politics is at best naive grade school patriotism, and at worst it's them not us racism. That this notion of lunatic conspiracy theories persists even after the truly non-corporate journalists have exposed the Bush camp's foreknowledge of 9/11 shows that the denial runs very deep. The person who spoke of lunatic conspiracy theories on the listserv said all they had to do is prop up the Green candidate, hoping it would divert enough votes. It's been tried in Oregon, close quote. But what if gaining that particular Senate seat was not the main goal? What if the main goal was to intimidate members of Congress? I think that has been tried also in the form of anthrax letters sent to Democratic leaders during the debate on the USA Patriot Act. It's worth noting that the anthrax was American-made, and the attack stopped once that unconstitutional abomination was passed. The next problem is the lily-livered leftist insistence that we focus on abstractions rather than on human actors who can be held accountable. There are times when social change has to be approached systemically, such as in passing amendments to the Constitution. But just what is a murderous power structure? Is it a high-voltage electrical tower come to life and gone berserk? How does a structure commit murder? What is a power structure but a group of people operating within a certain set of rules, rules which may include eliminating their enemies? In these cases, the only way to get to the root cause of the problem, as the structuralists like to call it, is to go after the criminals. Catch enough of them, and the system may change because the bad actors will realize they can't get away with murder. Focus on incremental institutional change during a revolutionary time like the present, and you may find yourself in an institution. As a journalist, what is most troubling to me about the comment made on the listserv is its source. It came from the news director of a community radio station, and it reflects a viewpoint held by so-called progressive writers such as Norman Solomon, David Korn, and Mark Cooper, who are respected in left media circles. In essence, what this news director is saying is that people in the independent media should eliminate certain lines of inquiry before the investigation fairly begins. By this approach, rather than testing the conspiracy theory against the facts, he refuses to even formulate the hypothesis. A comment such as, quote, "I don't like it when people start discrediting themselves, especially when they are in the alternative media business," reeks of the need for approval. Approval from whom? Certainly not the anti-war protesters who believe Wellstone was murdered, and those are the very people likely to be using independent media. Whenever someone says, "Don't go there, don't ask about that, don't investigate that," as Dick Cheney is saying about 9/11, this is the first place a reporter should go, ask about, and investigate. Anything else allows gatekeepers to limit the scope of the reporter's search for truth. Once that happens, journalism is turned into stenography for the power elite. Unfortunately, that is the way some of the lily-livered leftists would have it. And that was a piece by Kelly Ramirez, published in the online journal on November 7th. The title of the piece was Wellstone Murdered? It's a Legitimate Question Journalists Must Feel Free to Ask. Noam Chomsky is one of the world's foremost analysts of the use of propaganda as a means of controlling democratic societies. and is the author of dozens of books with a critical assessment of U.S. domestic and foreign policy. On November 4th, he spoke at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government on Why Iraq?
I'm disciplined, so I'll talk about what I was asked to talk about, which is Iraq and the connection between Iraq and the so-called war on terror. There is a connection. It's pretty thin, but it's been drawn. Intelligence agencies have pointed out that they can't detect any real connection between Iraq and the terrorist networks, Al-Qaeda and the rest, which isn't too surprising. But there is a connection, nevertheless, and it's been pointed out. Namely, we can create a link if we want, and the best way to create the link would be by attacking Iraq. It's expected widely that if we do attack Iraq, that's very likely to ignite terrorist attacks, maybe that are already being planned as a possible deterrent, and it's very likely to spawn a new generation of terrorists who will be seeking revenge and also deterrence. And the deterrence is not a slight matter. Those of you who've been following the international relations literature, I'm going to be very establishment in this talk. I'm only going to quote people right in the mainstream. People who've been following it know that leading scholars, respected figures in international relations, have been pointing out for some time, in fact, well before Bush, that U.S. adventurism is stimulating a proliferation of weapons of mass destruction as a deterrent. That's not just countries that are being specifically targeted for attack, but others who are concerned about deterring a state that seeks, I'm quoting now, unilateral world domination through absolute military superiority and is becoming a menace to itself and the world under a radical nationalist leadership. I've been quoting Kenneth Waltz, a well-known figure in international relations, and Anatole Yevin, who's the senior associate of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. In fact, even real hardliners are expressing pretty serious concerns. So one of the leading military and strategic analysts is concerned primarily with the Middle East, Anthony Cordesman, who's about as hard line as you can get within anything that might be called the spectrum of sanity. He's been warned recently against what he called the neoconservative fantasies of the sillier armchair strategists and their plans for reconstructing the Middle East and maybe the world. He was referring to Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, but that also includes Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, others, who all happen to be very close to the extreme right wing in Israel. So you're getting quite a lot of clear and good reporting from the mainstream Israeli press about them. As maybe you know, Richard Perle, who's very close to the center of planning now, and Douglas Feith were writing position papers for Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's new foreign minister, who's well to the right of Ariel Sharon. You know, so they were doing that in the 1990s, and that's their connections. And that's about the only connection I know of between Iraq and terrorism at the moment. We can stimulate terrorism if we really intend to. So why Iraq? I mean, obviously not in order to stimulate terrorism. Well, before going to that, begin with a kind of a truism, should be unnecessary to mention. In the case of either the threat of or a resort to violence, the burden of proof is always on those who advocate it. So that's true whether it's domestic abuse or international affairs. And it's a heavy burden. Maybe there's an argument for it, but it's those who advocate force and violence who have to bear the burden, and it's a heavy one. You never need any arguments against the use of violence. That's automatic. You need an argument for it. It has to be a very strong one. That should be obvious, and I'll just put it in back. So why do they want to do it? Just to simplify, since time's brief, I'll pick two views that are expressed pretty prominently in the mainstream, and I'll quote mainstream analysts. So here's the first interpretation. I'll start with Yusuf Ibrahim in the International Herald Tribune a couple of days ago. He's a senior fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations and was a senior Middle East correspondent for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal for about 30 years. So very recently moved to the CFR recently. His interpretation is that the goals of the Bush administration are basically two. One, gaining short-term political advantage, and two, I'm quoting him now, turning Iraq into a private American oil pumping station. Well, there's a counter-argument to that, against that in the New York Times yesterday, maybe a response to it, I don't know, by Serge Schmemann, who argues that kind of disparages the oil relationship on the grounds that there's not going to be an instant bonanza for Iraqi oil. That's true, but it's not a very persuasive argument. I mean, by the same argument, you can prove that nobody was interested in Iraqi oil 80 years ago, or Texas oil, or Saudi Arabian oil, or Venezuelan oil, or certainly not Alaskan or North Sea oil. I mean, really expensive to get it. So by that argument, yeah, it's true, you're not going to get the billions of dollars tomorrow, and it'll take development funds. But the argument is very weak. In fact, much weaker in the case of Iraqi oil, which is vast and relatively easily accessible than it was in numerous other cases. So I think we can dismiss the counter-argument, which was, I think, a front-page story in the Times we can review yesterday. Well, that's Yusuf Ibrahim. Yevon, who I quoted before, has a more detailed analysis along the same lines. He suggests that the Bush administration, the political aspect, is following, I'm quoting him, the classic modern strategy of an endangered right-wing oligarchy, which is to divert mass discontent into nationalism inspired by fear of enemies about to destroy us. And he speaks for many people in the world when he regards that as a menace to itself, meaning the country, and to the world. Well, September 11th provided a pretext for resort to force, not just for the United States. That's worldwide, and it was predicted at once. So the Russians in Chechnya, the Chinese against their Western minorities, Indonesia and Aceh, Israel and the occupied territories, I mean, all over the world, repressive governments that were engaged in violent repression used September 11th as a pretext to intensify it under the guise of a war on terror, and assuming correctly that they'd get a nod of approval from the boss in Washington. And it's not too surprising that the U.S. itself would adopt the same idea. So yes, 9/11 was a pretext, and it was also used as a pretext to discipline populations throughout the world, again, under the guise of a war on terror. And that ranges from the Central Asian dictatorships all the way over to the more democratic countries, including our own. So the fact that September 11th would prove a pretext for a war in Iraq is not a great surprise. Also, to pursue the domestic political agenda, as Levin points out, natural for an endangered right-wing oligarchy to do that, especially when it's carrying out quite an extensive attack against the domestic population. It's not a big secret, or it shouldn't be. In the U.S., that was pointed out right away, for example, by Paul Krugman and one of his well-known economists and one of his regular New York Times columns, who reported right away that literally before the dust had settled over the World Trade Center ruins, influential Republicans signaled that they were determined to use terrorism as an excuse to pursue a radical right-wing agenda. And he and others have been documenting how they've been following that course ever since. Again, shouldn't be a secret, so I won't pursue it. The Beast of Baghdad was then brought in to be an even more terrifying threat. And there are also independent reasons. There is a long-standing goal, Ibrahim and others are surely correct, and it's kind of obvious. It's been a long-standing goal to restore to U.S. control. It's been recognized ever since the mid-40s, quote, the State Department in 1945, that this is a major component of what they called a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history, and a major theme of U.S. foreign policy since the Second World War has been to make sure that the U.S. Dominates it. France was expelled on the interesting grounds that it was an enemy state since it had been occupied by Germany, so therefore its contracts were void, and England was slowly reduced to what the Foreign Office calls a, British Foreign Office calls a junior partner. The U.S. puts it differently. 40 years ago, a senior statesman, probably Dean Acheson, in internal discussion described Britain as our lieutenant. The fashionable word is partner, and they like to hear the fashionable word, but the reality is the actual word. And control over Middle East oil has been a very large part of it from the Second World War. Let me stress that it's control. It's not access. There's a lot of confusion about that. The United States really doesn't care much about access to Middle East oil. Up until 1970, it didn't care at all. You know, North America was the biggest producer, but it didn't affect the need to control the region. Since then, the biggest importer has usually been Venezuela. If you look at U.S. intelligence projections, for example, the National Intelligence Council projections for the next 15 years, they predict and suggest that the U.S. should rely on a more secure Atlantic Basin resources, West Africa and Latin America. But that has absolutely nothing to do with control over Middle East oil. Now, that has to do with its being one of the greatest material prizes in world history, which means that whoever controls it and can have an effect on setting price and production levels can also determine that the wealth, vast amount of the wealth, flows right back here, and it does. It's independent of access to oil. A stupendous source of strategic power has nothing to do with access. That has to do, that translates as a lever of world control, and that's been recognized clearly since the 1940s, and it remains true today. Well, September 11th gave a pretext. The domestic politics affects the timing, and the strategy has been working quite brilliantly. You see it right now in the midterm elections. It's going to be even more important next year, presumably. If you put yourselves in, say, Karl Rove's shoes, Bush's campaign manager, when the presidential campaign begins in a little over a year, do you really want people to be thinking about what's happening to their pension or how they're going to take care of their elderly mother or, what about their job or, you know, why can't they get health care? What about an environment that their children might live in? Things like that are certainly not what they want people to be paying attention to. They'll want people to be, singing praises to the brave cowboy who saved them from destruction at the hands of a colossal foe, sort of Martian foe, and will by then be marching on to some new adventure. Exactly as Gibbon says, that's the tradition, that's the classic strategy of an endangered right-wing oligarchy, which wants to divert mass content, which has plenty of ground, into nationalism and fear. And it takes a lot of work to overlook the fact that the only people who are afraid of Condoleezza Rice's mushroom cloud, which is going to consume us imminently, the only people who are afraid of it are Americans, not the people of the region, for example. I mean, they're afraid, but they're afraid of the United States more than they are of Iraq. Of course, Iraqis are afraid of Saddam Hussein, and they have every right to be, but that can't possibly be the reason for the U.S. war. I mean, the U.S. was supporting Saddam right through his worst atrocities, helping him develop weapons of mass destruction right up to the day of the invasion of Kuwait. And it's the same people who are running Washington right now. So whatever the reasons are, it's not that. They're afraid of Saddam Hussein, but they also know that he can't do very much. In fact, very little. If he made a move anywhere, Iraq would be obliterated. He knows that, and the people in the region know that. Even the U.S. press, the national press, which is usually highly supportive of power, now recognizes that, quoting the world, is more concerned about the unbridled use of American power than it is about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It's a lead story in the Christian Science Monitor a couple days ago, and it's been pointed out by others.